Psalm 88. O Lord, the God of my salvation, I have cried out by day and in the night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. For my soul has had enough troubles, and my life has drawn near to Sheol. I am reckoned among those who go down to the pit. I have become like a man without strength, forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and they are cut off from your hand. You have put me in the lowest pit, in the dark places, in the depths. Your wrath has rested upon me, and you have afflicted me with all your waves. You have removed my acquaintances far from me. You have made me an object of loathing to them. I am shut up and cannot go out. My eye has wasted away because of affliction. I have called upon you every day, O Lord. I have spread out my hands to you. Will you perform wonders for the dead? Will the departed spirits rise and praise you? Will your loving kindness be declared in the grave, your faithfulness in Abaddon? Will your wonders be made known in the darkness and your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness? But I, O Lord, have cried out to you for help, and in the morning my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why do you reject my soul? Why do you hide your face from me? I am afflicted and about to die from my youth on. I suffer your terrors. I am overcome. Your burning anger has passed over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. They have surrounded me like water all day long. They have encompassed me altogether. You have removed lover and friend far from me. My acquaintances are darkness. This really is a gloomy psalm, isn't it? This past week, I, in preparation and trying to get a hold and understanding of the wisdom of this psalm, the Lord providentially directed me to a academic lecture on Psalm 88 by a Jewish rabbi. It was quite fascinating to hear him go through this psalm and really express the exact same expression that Christian writers are expressing about this psalm. And all the way from the bottom line of their places in here, they don't know what the Hebrew means, all the way up to this being one of the most dark and gloomy psalms of all the psalms, and how do they reconcile that with who God is and all this. And really, the commentary he made and the commentaries that I've been reading in general pretty much mash together, which does disturb me and encourage me at the same time. It's encouraging because I know that I'm reading the text properly. Because when he was doing it, what he would do is he would read the Hebrew and then he would read the translation into English, and the class was participating. And the class was participating in English, so I could hear the English. I know a little bit of Hebrew, but not enough to really follow what he's going on other than the grammatical points that he was making. And it was just really there. That's encouraging, you know, even though this rabbi is not a believer in Jesus Christ. He's just looking at those words, looking at the grammar, looking at the definitions, and seeing what is being said in the psalm. The discouraging thing about it is that the things that he was saying as an unbeliever were the very same things I was reading in the commentaries. In other words, there wasn't any difference between the two. And is there something here that we should see? And I do think there is something here that we can see, and Lord willing, I hope to point that out for your consideration either next midweek service or the service after that. You have in your hands a piece of paper, and we have just read through this psalm. And I just want to read two quotations, two extended quotations that I came across in my study, and really as I providentially asked and looked at questions here, and both of these are quotations by Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Many of you are probably aware that Charles Haddon Spurgeon was an English pastor, very well known, probably the most well-known minister outside of the Apostle Paul, and probably one of the most read ministers outside of the Apostle Paul. His sermons, 66 volumes of sermons that he edited, and if you're over at my house, my wife got for me for one of our anniversaries an actual transcript of his handwritten editing of his sermons so that they could be printed and bound, and they were sold to people, and people bought them, and they were translated in multiple languages all over this world. And they're still being read today and still strengthening today. Which is amazing, isn't it, as we go. I've got all the hardback volumes, which cost a pretty nickel, but you can actually get them digitally on a little CD or digitally over the internet, and might cost you $5 today. And so you can avail yourselves of that. But see, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, in a book called An All-Around Ministry, made this comment. Do you not think that we all make mistakes as to what will be a blessing? In the matter of faith healing, health is set before us as if it were the great thing to be desired above all other things. Is it so? Spurgeon goes on and says, I venture to say that the greatest earthly blessing that God can give to any of us is health, with the exception of what? Sickness. Now, what do you think about that? The greatest earthly blessing that God can give to any of us is health, with only one exception, when we're sick. He goes on and says, sickness has frequently been of more use to the saints of God than health has. If some men that I know of could only be favored with a month of rheumatism, it would, by God's grace, mellow them marvelously. Assuredly, they need something better to preach than what they now give to their people, and possibly they would learn it in the chamber of suffering. I would not wish for any man a long time of sickness and pain, but a twist now and then one might almost ask for him. A sick wife, a newly made grave, poverty, slander, sinking of spirit, might teach lessons nowhere else to be learned so well. Trials drive us to the realities of religion. What do you think about that? It was good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn thy word, O God. You may feed on chaff until you have real work to do or real grief to bear, but then you'll want the old corn of the land, and you must have it or else you will faint and fall. He goes on and says, our afflictions come to us as blessings, although they frown like curses. I heard of one who was generous but extremely eccentric. A man who was deeply in debt passed by his door, and he knew that the poor debtor was terribly exercised about the matter. One day, this odd man of wealth, generous as he was so cruel as to throw a heavy bag at the poor debtor. The man was hurt by the missile and looked around to see what it was. He saw no man who had inflicted the injury, but he picked up the bag. He heard the chink of the coin, and when he opened the bag, he found enough to pay his debt, and he heard a voice saying, keep it for yourself. He never summoned that man for assault, but thanked him for the gift. So affliction comes to us like getting hit by a missile, right? But inside of it is treasure. And then he goes on and says, oft times has providence, with a rough hand, thrown countless gain in our way in the form of the trial of our faith, which is much more precious than gold. Blessed be the Lord, our temporary bruise is soon forgotten, but the spiritual gain abides forever. In any case, the calls of our Lord Jesus Christ is our calls, and we are linked with Him in a fellowship which cannot be broken, whatever that may involve. We have counted the cost, and we can say, from henceforth, let no man trouble me. I am the branded slave of Jesus, and my ear is bored for Him. Providence, with a rough hand, has thrown countless gain in our way. Have you found that to be true? When you're young in the Lord, you do not think that at all. But look at a seasoned saint and look at a mature saint, and you'll find a saint who looks back. He's not really thankful so much for the trial. He's thankful for the gain that he got in the trial, a gain which will not be taken away. So let's look at the back here in another sermon in volume 34 of the Metropolitan Tabernacle, entitled The Trial of Your Faith. Spurgeon preaches this to his people: the trial of your faith will increase, develop, and deepen, and strengthen it. Oh, you have said, I wish I had more faith. All right, I'm going to pause here. Anybody ever said you wish you had more faith? Okay. Oh, you say, I wish I had more faith. Your prayer will be heard through you having more trial. Often in our prayers, we have sought for a stronger faith to look within the veil. The way to stronger faith usually lies along the rough pathway of sorrow. What do you think about that? This is a man experienced, isn't he? He goes on, he says, only as faith is contested will faith be confirmed. I do not know whether my experience is that of all of God's people, but I'm afraid that all the grace that I've got out of my comfortable and easy times and happy hours might almost lie on a penny. But the good that I've received from my sorrows and pains and griefs is altogether incalculable. What do I not owe to the hammer and the anvil, the fire and the file? What do I not owe to the crucible and the furnace, the bellows that have blown up the coals, and the hand that has thrust me into the heat? Affliction is the best bit of furniture in my house. What do you think about that? It is the best book in a minister's library. When I was in my 20s, I would not have understood that statement. But now that I've been in the ministry almost over four decades, I can agree with that. The best book in the library is the book of affliction. We may wisely rejoice in tribulation because it works patience, and patience experience, and experience hope. And by that way, we are exceedingly enriched, and our faith grows what? Goes strong. I pray that that encourages someone here tonight. That the trials that you're going through have within that heavy bag treasure to be gained that you cannot ever take away. Because God's treasure is how long? Is forever. It's everlasting. So I wanted to print that out and read that, because that's really some of the things that this psalmist here is learning, is he not? Here he is. He's in the midst of his own personal furnace, very gloomy furnace. He's praying, O Yahweh, the God of my help, the God of my salvation. He's crying out to the Lord day and night. He prays, oh, let my prayer come before you and incline your ear to my cry. And as far as we know, toward the end of the psalm, it's not even answered, right? He's still praying this. And the other thing, brethren, is this. We don't know what the affliction is. It's probably physical, but it does spill over into his own spirit. And so it's interesting that in the Psalms, a lot of times it doesn't tell you the specific thing, because We all have different trial, right, that we can identify with here in this psalm. So let's go through. I'm just going to go through verse by verse, and I'm just going to try to explain what the verse is saying. You may want to jot down some notations to help you guide you back through this psalm in the days and years ahead when you go back through. Verse 3. For my soul has had enough troubles, and my life has drawn near Sheol. The phrase had enough is a word that really means to be filled up or to be satisfied. And you'll notice that the word troubles there, which refers to evils, various evils, is plural. This isn't one thing that is coming upon him. And he says, my soul is satisfied. It's filled up with troubles to this point that my life has been drawn. It has arrived near to Sheol. Now, Sheol is the place of the dead. Okay, when you read the word Sheol in the Old Testament, for a simplistic definition, it's the place of the dead. So what he's saying here is this. Lord, if I could word it this way without appearing, you know, inappropriately. Lord, I've had enough. Have you ever said that? You say, oh, I'd never say it to the Lord, but have you said that to yourself? Yes, well, you've said it to him. Okay, I've had enough. I've had enough what? I've had enough trouble. I'm tired of all the troubles. My soul, I liken this to eating. I wrote a little paraphrase. My soul is stuffed with troubles. I can't even take in anymore. And you know, brethren, physical evils are vanity enough, but when your soul is filled up with troubles, who can bear that? And so here, this psalmist Heman is filled up. Verse 4, I am reckoned among those who go down to the pit. I have become like a man without strength. He's accounted. People look at him and look at his troubles and look at his afflictions. And people count him as, you know, he's ready to what? What does it mean to go down into the pit? He's ready to die. People look at him and they're saying he's near death. He's like a man without strength. And I don't know if you've ever had the occasion to be with someone that is with hours or just a few days of dying. And I've said this so frequently in a hospital bed or in a home. You look at that person, they don't even look like themselves. They're in many cases, they're skin and bones. They don't even have enough strength to talk. This is like this man is. This man is accounted by other people as being just ready to fall into a dug grave, and he has no strength. His powerlessness of this man is just like a man who's right at the point of death. Verse 5. Forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and they are cut off from your hand. The word forsaken here means to be freed or to be liberated. It's like God liberates him, sets him free to what? To die. And folks, you and I, we live by the will of God in the sense that if God does not will for you to have the strength to live, you will what? You will die. And if the God of heaven says, I liberate you, I free you to death, then what's going to happen? You're going to die. And this is the way Haman is feeling. He's been freed among the dead ones. He's like in war when a person is struck down by another. And they're just lying on the what? They're lying on the ground. And they're moaning. And they're just waiting to what? Waiting to die. If you go around to some of these Civil War areas or listen to some of the Civil War recollections, I remember watching a a film one time, and they talked about up here in Mechanicsville when the Confederate and the Union soldiers were right next to each other and they would battle. And then at night, what they would do is they would send people over to the other side and they would exchange news and all this. And after one of the battles, it said that you could just hear moaning and crying and really crying out for water because they were dying. They were just strewn out all over the field there. This is how this man is feeling. And he feels forsaken to the point that God does not remember him. In other words, Haman doesn't come into the memory of God. God has cut him off. And folks, the phrase cut off gives the impression, you remember when it says that if an Israelite sins, they were to be what from the nation? They were to be cut off from the nation. And what the psalmist is saying here is this, and this is frightening, that the Lord's providence toward him, and it is the Lord doing this, yes? The Lord's providence to him were providences that were reserved for the wicked, not for the righteous. In other words, you expect wicked people, when they do wickedness, God does visit them in judgment, does he not? And the wages of sin is death. In other words, the psalmist is not experiencing a natural death. He's not experiencing in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and 13. He's experiencing the Lord's providence in his life as if he was a wicked man. Is he a wicked man? No. How do we know that? He's crying out to the Lord. This is not a wicked man, but the providences in his life are as if he was what? A wicked man. Now, folks, you can imagine what that will do to your soul, to your thinking. As you think about the Lord is good, is he not? He's righteous altogether. And yet, he believes that the Lord's treating him as if he was a wicked man, but he's not a wicked man. How do you reconcile this? Would you not agree that that would be enough trouble for your soul? And so, Haman doesn't come to the mind of the Lord. He feels cut off from his hand. Verse 6, you, the Lord, has put him in the lowest pit, in dark places, in the depths. And of course, the pit here is again referring to the grave. And remember, he feels like that he's just reckoned, he's accounted as those that are just about to die. And he says, you just haven't put me in a pit, you put me in the lowest pit. You just haven't put me in places of darkness. You put me in the darkness of darkness. And of course, we understand, do we not, that the darkness of darkness and the lowest of the pit and the depths of the depths are not reserved for the righteous. They're reserved for who? The wicked. Verse 7, your wrath has rested upon me. And you have afflicted me with all your waves. You might want to write above all your waves, Jonah chapter 2 and verse 3. You remember when he got thrown off the boat and the waves were calm. He says in his poetry that all of God's waves were over him. And folks, the picture of this is this. God's wrath rested on him. It was like a weight. And God oppressed him with that wrath like the waves. Now, what does that refer to? Have you ever seen a picture of the waves coming in? Okay, what happens? Waves comes in and batters the sand. Wave goes out. Then what happens? Another wave follows it. This is what's happening to this man. One wave of affliction, another wave of what he felt like was God's wrath. Another wave of wrathful affliction, another wave coming. In other words, there's no reprieve. And if he does get a reprieve, it's only for how long? It's only for a little while before he gets hit with another one. And so whatever's happening to this man, we do know that this is a chronic situation. Can we word it that way? This is something that has been going on for a while. And brethren, I just want to encourage you that whenever, I hope it's never you. But when you're dealing with a believer who has a chronic physical condition, you can be assured that no matter how cheerful they may be when they are talking with you, they in their soul have had to deal with things. They've had to deal with things about their thoughts about God. They've had to deal with the darkness that's there in their own soul. It's not easy to have something chronic. Do we understand that? And somehow sometimes we're flipping. I've been this way in my younger years. You know, you go up and say, well, brother, I know you can't walk and move and you're totally disabled, but all things work together are good. You know, well, that's easy to say when you're walking and moving and, you know. But you got to understand that that person has a soul that's being battered not only by his providence, he's being battered by his sin nature to disbelieve God. And there's nothing worse than something happening in your life and it throws your understanding of God into confusion. Folks, our proper understanding of God is our rock. He is in the deep places and he is being hit wave after wave after wave. Verse 7, pause and think about that. Verse 8, you have removed my acquaintances far from me. You have made me an object of loathing to them. I am shut up and cannot go out. You know, it's one thing to have physical infirmity. It's another thing to have soul affliction. Both of those are awful. Both of those are connected. But when you add on top of that, isolation. When people avoid you. That happened to Job, didn't it? Job's affliction was so awful, people would actually pass by, as it were, on the other side of the road. And folks, we do the same things because sometimes you can go, I feel this, you feel this, and look at somebody who's in severe affliction physically. And you just don't even want to look at it. You don't know what to say. You don't know how to handle it because you don't know how to handle it. And this man had had all of his acquaintances removed, all the comforts of people removed, and it was all due to the ugliness of his affliction and the perception by people that the wrath of God was upon him. In fact, he was an object of horror to them. And you take isolation like that, and you take physical affliction like that, and you take soul affliction like that, and you put all that on an individual, and add this, verse 8, I am shut up and cannot go out. In other words, he was imprisoned. We don't know to what. He was imprisoned to his room. He was imprisoned in his house. He was imprisoned on a bed. He couldn't go where? He couldn't leave because of this. And one of the things I remember talking to our dear brother who's now with the Lord, who was bound in a wheelchair, I remember him saying to me, Pastor, I'm imprisoned in this body. And that's the way you feel when you're dying. And that's why people say, I just want to go and be with the Lord. Imagine if these things were upon you. Verse 9, my eye is wasted away because of affliction. I have called upon you every day, O Lord. I have spread out my hands to you. In other words, wasted away means his eyes have been growing weak. It could have been because of his tears. It could have been because of his sorrow. It could have been because of lack of strength. But because of the affliction that he had, that his eye was growing weak. And in spite of all that, I mean, brother, how would you like to have all that all at one time? I'm going to tell you, not me, O Lord. Please not me, O Lord. I'm not strong enough. Feel that way? Okay. But in spite of all that, his faith is radiating, isn't it? Has he forsaken the Lord? No, because, brethren, if the Lord has sent the affliction, the Lord also can remove the affliction. Right? And he's petitioning the Lord. I've called upon you every day. I spread out my hands to you. And then in verses 10 through 12, he asked the Lord six questions. And these are questions based on this fact. And let me help you out. I'll tell you what it's based on. I think you'll see it. The psalmist feels like the providences that God has sent his way are providences that are reserved for what kind of people? Wicked people. All right, where do wicked people go when they die? They go to the place of destruction, don't they? They go to hell. Okay. He's going to ask questions as if he was in that place. Like, Lord, you're treating me as if I was wicked, but let me ask you this. If you're treating me like I'm wicked and you put me in the place of the dead wicked, can this happen? Verse 10. Will you perform wonders for the dead? Will the departed spirits rise and praise you? In other words, folks, when wicked people die and they go to hell, are they praising God? Yes or no? No, their time and their opportunity to praise God is over. It's gone. They're not going to rise up from hell and give God praise. But what is this psalmist doing? Is he praising God? Well, the answer to that is yes, or else he wouldn't have said, if you send me to the place of the wicked dead, then I wouldn't praise you. He is praising God, isn't he? Verse 11. Will your loving kindness be declared in the grave? Your faithfulness in, I'm going to translate that, the place of destruction, the place of the ungodly dead. In other words, folks, Haman is praising God for his goodness. Is he telling others the Lord is faithful? Loving kindness is the term chesed. Is he telling God that God is loving? Yes or no? Yes. But if you're going to treat me as if I'm wicked and I go to the place of the wicked dead, I won't say that you're loving kindness there. Wicked people don't do that. Wicked people, when they go to hell, they don't tell each other God's faithful to send me to hell because I was wicked. They're gnashing their teeth in rebellion against God. There's no praise in hell. There's no celebration in hell. There's no talking about the goodness of God in hell. There's no confessing that God is faithful in hell. It's the exact opposite. There's no form of merciful hearing on anything in hell. And then verse 12, will your wonders be made known in the darkness and your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness? Folks, ungodly people, and this might help you, ungodly people live their lives this way. They live their lives forgetting God. When they die, they're going to go to a place where God forgets them. Now, how many of you understand God doesn't forget? Okay? But he's speaking in our language, right? When you forget somebody, what does it mean? They don't enter into your mind, your thinking. Will God's wonders be made known in the darkness? And folks, when people die and go to hell, they're not partying with their neighbor. They've had all their parties and friends and companions in this life. When a person dies and goes to hell, they are in absolute isolation, in complete darkness, all by themselves forever. That's terrifying. And nobody talks about righteousness and goodness in that place. In other words, folks, nobody in hell is talking about the knowledge of God. And the word Abaddon in verse 11 is repeated in Revelation chapter 9 and verse 11. And this is why we know that this is the place of destruction. It's the place where ungodly people go when they die, because in Revelation chapter 9 and verse 11, it talks about the angel of the abyss. And so what Heman feels like, he feels like the Lord is providentially dealing with him as if he was wicked, to be cut off from the people of God. He argues that if he was such a person like that, then he would end up in ungodly with the ungodly dead, and they give no praise to God, and they do not confess that Yahweh is loving and faithful, and they do not speak of his works of righteousness. All that would cease from his lips, because there are no such things in the land of the departed wicked. There's only gnashing of teeth and cursing and torment and aloneness and isolation and darkness forever and ever. Everybody see what he's arguing? In other words, I really don't deserve to be treated as if I'm wicked, because I'm not. And I'm seeking you in the place of all this. And so he shows that contrast, verse 13. What's the very first word? But. Everybody see that? In contrast to the previous verses, in contrast to people who forget God, and so God therefore forgets them, Heman's not doing that. He is seeking Yahweh. He is crying out to the Lord for help. And in the morning, his prayer is coming before God. Everybody see how he's arguing here? Okay. He's not saying he's perfect, but he is righteous, isn't he? And he is seeking the Lord, and he is calling on the name of the Lord. And so I think, my personal opinion is, verses 14 through 18 are the summary of the years of his life. Why do you reject my soul? Why do you hide your face from me? Note verse 15. I was afflicted and about to die from when? My youth on. The Hebrew word for youth there is a word, na'ar, which is sometimes is translated in modern Hebrew as teenager. The psalmist started this affliction in his what years? In his teen years. And from those years, he lived a life where he was about to what? He was about to die. And the affliction, did it get better? No, it's like the waves, right? It gets worse and worse and worse until we're at this point where he's writing this psalm down by inspiration. And he's just on the edge of death. He says, I suffer your terrors. I carry your terrors. They're like a burden or a load on my shoulder. The word terrors are used three times out of six in the book of Job. I suffer your terrors, and I am overcome. In other words, the terrors are like a weight on his shoulders. And what happens? He collapses under the weight. He's overcome. Your burning anger has passed over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. God's fury was over him, and the terrors, like waves that were coming into him and caused him to be overcome, were destroying him. How many terrors were there? Verse 17, they surrounded him like water all day long. They encompassed him altogether. And the imagery there is this. It's like you took an individual and you put him in a pool of water. The water are the terrors. And the terrors are all around him. They're over his head. They're on his side. They're like Jonah, right? The terrors are all around him, and they encompass him. And what that means is it closes in on him. It's just not broad terrors. It gets weightier and weightier and more oppressive and more oppressive and more oppressive. And there is no escape. Verse 18, you have removed lover. It's interesting, the word lover is singular. So is the word friend. You have removed lover and friend far from me. And my acquaintances, those are people who just know you in general. My acquaintances are in darkness. And we're not quite sure what that means. It could mean that his acquaintances is darkness. It could mean that his acquaintances, people who are looking upon him and his condition, really don't understand his condition. They're in darkness about the true knowledge of what's going on in his soul. But in any case, it is a very despondent psalm, is it not? And I can honestly say this, it would not be a psalm that I would want to pray with experience. Would you? But I will say this in closing. All of us have different maturities and different levels of strength to bear things. You could feel this way. Am I right? You could feel this way about a long-standing soul problem that you have to keep battling over and over and over. You could feel like that the providences, the circumstances of your life, you don't understand it because you would think the Lord would not do that to you. I mean, the wicked, yeah, Hitler, sure, you know. The Democratic Party, amen. Republican, go get them, you know. But not me. I'm in church, I'm giving, I'm reading my Bible, I'm doing the things I'm supposed to do, I'm witnessing of God's loving kindness, and yet, you get hit. And I'm going to speak for myself here. The greatest soul trouble is when there is no escape from it. If you've got something that you can do to give a relief, there's hope, right? But when there's no escape and you get hit and hit and hit and hit and it comes in and in and in and oppressive and oppressive and oppressive and burdening and burdening and burdening and there's nothing you can do to remove it except what? Turn to the Lord. That is the most oppressive. And we're going to leave it there. And brethren, what I hope to do next midweek service, I hope to give you some wisdom out of this psalm. And the wisdom that we can get out of this psalm will encourage you about the goodness of God. Let's pray.